What's a person who's an expert in non-lethal weaponry doing at a UFO crash retrieval conference? In a moment, find out as John Alexander joins Linda Moulton Howe and me next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to the UFO Crash Retrieval Conference here in Las Vegas. Dr. John Alexander is a leading advocate for the development of non-lethal weaponry. Well, what's he doing at a UFO conference?
It's a very good question because I met this man sitting next to me here in this studio years ago at UFO conferences. And you know, John, when we first met, it was in the context of General Stubblebine and remote viewing and what you had done with Army intelligence. And it seems to me that if I boil down everything that I remember from that period of time, it was that remote viewing had, at least through Ingo Swann and others, provoked enough information about the possibility of disks, UFOs, non-human life forms here, and that this was being done under Pentagon, I guess you would say, context.
Well, I'd agree with about 90% of that.
Well, talk about
all except the
part
that
sounds like a military man.
Yeah. 90%.
The part I wouldn't agree with has to do with the Pentagon interest. As you know, I'm giving a talk there, and I have to say there's good news and there's bad news. The good news is the government's been telling you the truth. The bad news is the government's telling you the truth. They simply don't care. And contrary to, I mean, it sounded to me from the last half hour that ET has a quality control problem. We've got these advanced technologies going a gazillion miles and falling down all over the world, and very tough. No, I have spent a lot of time.
That is a good observation, though.
Are you saying that you have hard proof that there are not crashed disks, triangles, cylinders on this planet that have been retrieved?
Yeah, I would. You can't prove a negative. I would say the evidence supporting it is much slimmer than most of your audience would believe. I'm going to talk to a lot of this at the conference and some of the things they were saying. We were off air. We were discussing, I call it the presidential paradox.
And that is?
We have just come through a very, very nasty election. It was very, very close, all negative. We've had two such elections in the past that have been, you know, squeaky close. Remember Bush 2000 and how close that went. It's my position that if they, whoever they are, had access to the information, and these are people who you purport control, technologies and all that.
The MJ-12 type.
Yeah. At some point, they would have used it. I mean, and you only got to swing the vote. We're not talking about moving 40% of the voters. We're talking 2 or 3%. Makes, you know, would have changed the outcome in at least three presidential elections.
But
I believe,
John,
it would have been used.
John, that is a schizophrenic argument, because if there is a policy of denial in the interest of national security, then no sitting group, no matter who they are and what they are in 2008, is going to use the very material that is defined as a threat to national security.
Well, I don't know who defined it as a threat to national security.
Truman.
Who?
Harry S. Truman is the story.
Well, I don't believe anybody believes that. I happen to think they should. I think there are, you know, this is where it is. You have some very strong evidence that says we've had major interactions with some unknown craft that have, you know, interrupted our strategic systems.
From some very prominent people, too. Yeah.
And Malmstrom Air Force Base being one of the major ones.
Yes. Yeah. And the point is that they look at, this is the most disconcerting thing to me, is they go out and they look at it, say, haven't been able to figure this out, and go, what the hell, we'll move on. And I think the discussion that you had about where the world is today is very germane. See, I argue that, you know, in fact, most of the people in the U.S. believe in UFOs. However, believing in UFOs and thinking this is important is a very, very different thing. And I think that you will find that, you know, you have a small subset who attend conferences like this who feel very passionately about that. And they also think that, by the way, this is a voting issue. And there was discussion about what do you do with Congress. The answer is absolutely nothing. I mean, they will laugh. And I'm going to talk about the potential. We had a few years ago the potential to have congressional hearings, and it got shot down because of, you know, when the Disclosure Project went out and started beating the drums and all that, and everybody headed for the hills. I will tell you, the congressman who was involved, because I wrote the draft of charter that was going to be used in this, and I looked him in the eye and said, can you take a 20-point hit? And he happened to have said yes. And that's not an arbitrary figure, but this is not a good thing. I don't know if you're reading
saying,
the news tonight.
Wait, let him finish.
Tonight, you'll notice that Obama is apologizing to Nancy Reagan for a comment
on seances.
So the point is, from a public perspective, a political perspective, this is not a good thing.
Exactly.
Well,
it's way too early in the ball game to start offending people.
What you meant was it would be a 20-point drop if a congressman tried to lead out and say, we want to get to the bottom of the UFO story.
Especially nowadays with the priorities, Iraq and the economy and things like that.
Yeah. Well, let me tell you, as you know, I put out a thing before the election because I wanted to be kind of on the record. And my position was, if they exist, whoever they are, and like you said, maybe an MJ-12, maybe government, maybe quasi-government, maybe an industry, if they had that technology and had perfected it to point, and the rumors are out there, we've seen these things flying around. In my view, it would have been released before the election, the intent in swinging the election, because I am sure they would have strongly supported McCain. We do know from CEOs of major corporations that they were very strongly in favor of McCain over Obama. As the thing closed, they would have done it. Why? For two reasons. Our economy is at best unstable and potentially chaotic. And if you look at what happened, by the way, after the election and what's happened to the stock market, today it bounced up a little bit, but it was a big record hit this week. Yeah, record hits, and certainly record hits following an election. If they own this technology, and it is about energy, it's not about zipping around neat little, you know, craft and things, then you've got to have a mechanism by which the wealth is transferred to you. And you can't have that if your economic system is in chaos. So there would have been strong impetus to make sure that the system remains as strong as possible. And you didn't see it.
How do you react, though, John, to like a U.S. pilot, military pilot, who says while in England, in the United Kingdom, they have files there, 50 years ago, he was ordered to let all his weaponry go on a UFO that he said showed up on radar, was huge, and took off at what he estimated to be 10,000 miles an hour, which in those days, we didn't have anything like that.
Right.
What do you say about that?
What I say is we have had a number of such interactions, not usually violent ones, but ones in which, you know, there's definitely interaction between us and them, whoever them are. And we haven't done anything. This is why I'm saying that's the bad news, is that these incidents occur. They occur with some degree of regularity, and they're just putting the too tough to handle bin.
Well, maybe so. So you would agree that whatever's going on, it's pretty darn strange.
Well, yeah. And when we did, like I said, when I drafted the charter for potential congressional hearings, it did not happen. There were two particular issues. One was national defense, and the other one was air safety, because you have had a series of interactions that have impacted the potential for air safety.
Right.
And I say the bad news is they ignore it. And a lot of it, I'll go back to Condon, because I think most people fail to understand the impact that the Condon report had. For a strange reason, he was right, by the way. The question to Condon was not, are there UFOs? It was, are UFOs a threat? And his response was, no threat.
Well, then that was misinterpreted by the media to make it seem like it was a negative report debunking the existence of UFOs.
But the damage that he did cannot be underestimated, because not only did he say it's not that, he said also, and you will not study this, you know, that you made it so all scientists, you know, you risk your career, and I can show you some scars if you're out there and you talk about these things in the conventional media. It's getting better, but over time.
But Stanton Friedman would argue, if he were sitting here, that Condon was under some order to come to a conclusion that would take the heat off of the Air Force back, they would come out with a policy that the University of Colorado physicists said there's nothing to this.
Air Force got exactly what they wanted. An action passed is an action handled.
Right.
We do, you know, I got asked today, in fact, I saw a T-shirt that said, doing the Air Force's job since 1949. The point is, they are the Air Force, they come under the Department of Defense. You know, if there's no threat, Department of Defense doesn't get involved.
And the people who have had all the secrets have been AEC and the Navy right from the beginning.
Have been what?
The Atomic Energy Commission and the Navy is where most of the extraterrestrial knowledge craft, that's where it went. The Air Force, in some ways, was almost itself used as a deflection.
Air Force is responsible for air and space, and they were the ones responsible. And what they did not want to do, remember how the government works, and one of my major arguments, I'm going to discuss this as well, is people don't understand how the government works, okay, and how these macro systems work, why they do what they do. Now, this is national defense. They have one-to-end priority list. You got a limited amount of money, and you run out of money long before you get to end. And so anything you can move, you know, things that are very important to you, they get funded. Things like this are really a nuisance.
What about the black ops programs, though, John? And we know they exist.
That's pretty broad.
There could be a budget of $1 publicly, but $5 below the line.
Are there, programs that you don't see? Absolutely. But, and I think this is one of the misperceptions. There's a huge misperception, and I heard, our favorite Canadian former Minister of Defense get in and say, there's $1 trillion missing and nobody knows where it goes. Absolutely not true. Even within what you call black budgets, there is A, oversight, and B, fierce fighting, because they too have one-to-end priorities and have run out of money long before they got out of neat ideas of things they want to do.
Rumsfeld himself, right before 9/11, was on television talking about the huge, gigantic amount of money that they could not account for in the Pentagon.
Yeah, but understand what he was doing. I mean, A, that was a political ploy. B, it's not that there isn't some money that has not been accounted for. But he was, again, it was before 9/11, which is critical, because this was before the global war on terror and that, and what he was trying to do was to make major changes in the way the Pentagon does business, probably do. And I think he vastly, because I heard the statement too, but vastly overstated it for his own political purposes.
Well, let's pin you down for a second here, Dr. Alexander. These incredible things that so many people report, average citizens, former astronauts, dedicated people, what do you think is going on? What's your gut tell you? Now, I know you say whoever they may be, but what do you think, really think?
Yeah, you're right. Pin me down. We haven't got enough time for that. It was something I mentioned tonight at the thing. As you know, UFOs are not the only phenomena that I'm interested in. Looking at a wide range of things, you know, I'm involved with remote viewing and the IRVA organization. I did a lot of work in psychokinesis. I've just spent a couple of weeks in the Peruvian Amazon with the shamans down there. Whatever it is, it's terribly complex.
So you admit it's something.
Oh, absolutely.
That's a big step.
Physical, and this is one of the things I usually start with a position. Here's my position. Absolutely real in physical reality as we know it, at least at some points. Because I do think that there are things that transit our temporal domain, as we know it. and I suspect they go someplace else. And, you know, but how you put all this together, I don't know. But the problem is it's terribly complex, and it does look like consciousness is a key component.
True.
And had you ever seen anything when you were in Army Intel that was either a photograph of an actual aerial machine classified or a body? What about in remote viewing? Did you have anything like Ingo Swann has talked about accessing?
Well, I'm familiar with Ingo, and they did some playing around with, you know, kind of a test.
Well, he found a disc behind a submarine.
I know, but did I ever say anything? What I can tell you, because I was in a position to see highly classified reports and what was in the open domain, I would tell you that 98% of the information was already in the public domain. The main things that were missing were what we call sources and methods. In other words, how did you get it? How good were the satellites and those sorts of things? But getting back to something you said earlier, George, not only do we have witnesses, but basically every sensor system we have has picked up anomalies.
Right.
I mean, so
that's an incredible story.
And it's across the board.
And if it is extraterrestrial biological entity, a phrase that's been in our own documents of government, at least those that have been leaked as being real, then it means at some point in the last 60 years, somebody serving in government used those three words, extraterrestrial biological entity, to categorize something.
Linda, let's remember, you say the number of people that would have transcended the government in the time frame you're talking about are in tens of millions. There's no doubt. I don't think there's any set of words that exist that haven't been, you know, put into documents someplace on any topic.
I'm referring to the Psalm 101, the document on retrieval.
That. Yeah, I'm going to talk about, in fact, I think one of the things.
Well, you're the only one then who is outside of that.
Yeah. I'm going to talk to that because, A, the government has secrets. We know that. The secrets have come out. And I argue that a good thing to look at is look what happened in Watergate versus MJ-12 and look at how that information was gotten. I think there's a hard correlation, and Majestic does not stand up.
What do you mean? Some sort of a corollary between Watergate and MJ-12? What do you mean?
You had a deep, dark secret that they wanted out. The source in Watergate was known. They went to the Washington Post, mm-hmm. a respected entity that had massive resources behind it, that had the ability to research it. They gave it to young but good reporters. They vetted the source and all that. The other one, we got mysterious documents that show up in somebody's mailbox and hope that somebody will pick it up to people who are not in the system, who have no resources. Now, if you want the information out, there are ways to do it, and we have seen them. And I think those, the parallels are just dramatic.
Are you excluding Kenneth Arnold's eyewitness sighting? Are you excluding all of the people in 1947 who were talking photographing this?
No. He's not. I don't think he's excluding what they're seeing or what they're doing.
No, not at all. No, the reports are absolutely there. The part I have is there's a big conspiracy. I have talked to the senior levels of, kind of across the board, didn't have it.
Looking forward to your speech at the UFO Crash Retrieval Conference, John Alexander. We'll be back in a moment with Nick Pope, former official of the United Kingdom's Ministry of Defense. We'll be back. At the UFO Crash Retrieval Conference with Linda Moulton Howe, and I was watching here at the KXNT studios, Dr. Roger Lear was wandering by, and so Tommy grabbed him and brought him in for a second. Roger, what are you doing here?
Well, George, you should know by now that I'm always interested in anything, especially that which is so interesting and important in the field of ufology, and especially that which has to do with physical evidence.
Truly dedicated in your profession, my friend. And I've been hearing some scuttlebutt around this conference that you have done a television pilot.
Yes, we have, and we expect it to air perhaps during Sweeps Week, which is usually this month. It's going to be a very, very interesting show because it involves the 15th in our series of surgeries that we have performed for the removal of objects which appear to be non-terrestrial implants in humans.
As soon as you get a date, you let us know and I can pass it on.
I certainly will, George.
That's Dr. Roger Lear, back in a moment. Well, it's good to see Nick Pope up front. Nick Pope, an official for the UK's Ministry of Defense from 1985 to 2006. He was also the desk officer responsible for investigating officially documented UFO sightings and to determine whether they involved any potential threat to the UK. Nick and his colleagues became privately convinced that there was an important defense, national security, and flight safety issues involved here with unexplained phenomenon.
And you know, Nick, we've all been hearing about this really important historic case in which a pilot is saying he was ordered to try to shoot down with everything he had a disc. And I'm curious, in the context of what I've been exposed to for about a decade from both a New Mexico representative who had leaks from people in the Naval Research Lab in White Sands, that he is also getting that we had standing orders in the United States from the Truman administration till around 1953 or 54. And that he told me, Len Stringfield told me before Len died, that we lost so many American pilots and so many planes trying to carry out an order to attack the discs. For what reason? We wanted the technology. Is there anything that has come out of your work and any of these documents that you've seen that maybe some of us haven't, that would suggest that the United States and England were both working on a policy to bring down discs?
I mean, rules of engagement is always a very, very difficult area to discuss. And rules of engagement, the general position is that even if you know the details, you can't discuss that. I mean, I was surprised to see this case in the files. But let me I'll make a qualification because I think this is quite an important one. We're talking, you raised the question of the pilot Milton Torres and his testimony that in 1957, although there is actually some confusion about the date, and there's maybe suggestion that it's 56, he claims that in response to uncorrelated targets being tracked on the radar, he was vectored towards this UFO and given the shoot-down order. He then claims that he was about to carry out that shoot-down order when the UFO just accelerated away at such an impossible speed. He simply wasn't able to take that action. The important qualification in this particular incident is to say that the document that people have taken this story from in the Ministry of Defense case file, in the second batch of files that were released on October 20th, it is a genuine document from it genuinely does come from the Ministry of Defense files, and you can find it on the National Archives website. However, it's not a Ministry of Defense or a United States Air Force witness statement. What it is, if you go to the next document, or rather the preceding document, you'll see there's a cover letter actually from a UFO researcher saying this is a transcript of a write-up that Milton Torres did. So now, of course, many of you will have seen Milton Torres in the media discussing mm-hmm. this in the first person, sure. So I'm not in any way trying to disparage the individual, who's obviously a brave and honorable man, nor am I trying to disparage the story. But I am simply saying that in terms of following the paper trail, it is important to realize that we have not got, and a lot of UFO researchers think we've not got an official USAF report. And that, of course, is one of the interesting things. Where is that report? But you're right. I mean, speaking more generally, of course, and again, I'm not going to discuss rules of engagement, but I mean, whether there's a standing shoot down order is one question. We certainly know, and many people will be familiar with other incidents, and I'm thinking particularly of Parviz Jafari, Iran, 1976, Comandante Huertes from Peru in 1980. Those were certainly shoot-down situations. In Parviz Jafari's case, of course, He wasn't able to fire his weapon system because that was the one part of the system that didn't work. Whether that was caused by the UFO or not, we don't know. Comandante Huertes in Peru in 1980, of course, did fire his machine cannon, and he testifies, and this is on the record, that the rounds struck the craft, whatever it was, and the fighter controller had given a shoot-down order because this was unauthorized aerial activity in a restricted military area. He said that these rounds were, in his words, absorbed by the craft.
And we've heard that before. And Nick, if I'm hearing what you're saying, to you who worked inside of the British government, you're saying it's almost more interesting to you the fact that Torres is willing to talk his own firsthand experience, but that you cannot find an official government document.
Yes, now that doesn't necessarily...
Yeah, that's not unusual.
It's not unusual, but on the other hand, neither does it mean there's a conspiracy or a cover-up. I mean, I was 21 years in government, not just on the UFO job, but in security and finance. I was a briefer, and I'm afraid to admit, but I think anyone who's been in government will admit this, I have lost documents before. I've probably...
Those crummy little metal file cabinets they forced us to use.
I've mainly because I've misfiled things. But now in the electronic age, of course, there's a different set of problems to do with, all sorts of electronic filing issues. We don't have the original report from Milton Torres, and I think it's a very important question. Where is it?
And you know the MJ-12... Majestic documents, all of the stuff that Ryan and Bob have gotten and others. So we have this huge, we'll call it a pool of alleged government documents in the United States that fall under the MJ-12 magic, sort of, if you want to call it as a genre in the United States. Is there anything in the UK that comes close to being like the Majestic 12 documents that have been leaked, released, or discussed here?
No, there are certainly a number of fairly highly classified documents. For example, ones from the Defense Intelligence Staff, which is part of the Ministry of Defense, and they're people that I was not part of the Defense Intelligence Staff myself, but I worked alongside them on the UFO issue. There are certainly a number of Defense Intelligence Staff documents which have been released under the Freedom of Information Act, which talk about UFOs, sometimes in quite interesting and speculative terms. The exotic possibilities. We tried never to use words like alien or extraterrestrial. What there isn't in these files is a smoking gun that says, yes, we have something, or we know something for sure. There's an awful lot of material, often at levels of classification up to and including secret UK eyes only, which is almost as high as it gets before you get top secret, that... You know, says there is something in our airspace and we don't know what it is, and it might be something exotic, but there's nothing that says we know for a fact it's extraterrestrial and we've got some hardware.
Do you think it would make any political sense, historic sense, that the United States government would have kept secrets about extraterrestrial biological entities and their technology from our longtime mother and ally, England?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. My position on this would be, yes, Britain and America are very, very close allies, but actually, for the very reasons that I think I heard earlier in the show you articulating, certainly I think I've heard you and others say this before, this might be the one secret that if America did have it, and I don't know whether you do or don't, I would be tempted to keep it to myself. I mean, after all, the country on Earth that first acquires extraterrestrial technology, if it's there to be acquired, is going to be the dominant force on this planet for the next 10,000 years. Those are high stakes. True. To keep it to yourself. And let me tell you something, as someone with 21 years experience in the MOD, I can tell you, if we, the British, had this, we would not, I don't think,
wouldn't share it with the Americans.
Why should we? We would want that technology for ourselves. For military reasons, for political reasons, for industrial and financial reasons.
So we'd be singing Rule Britannica here.
Absolutely right. We want our empire back.
Well, knew it.
This comes then right to the heart of a subject I'm going to be talking about tomorrow at the conference, i.e. the Bentwaters-Rendlesham Forest story, of which there are so many facets, because apparently there were so many people involved. And in the work that I have done with James Peniston and John Burroughs, and some of that has, tomorrow will be the first time that it will have ever been exposed to the public, what I'm going to present. It has convinced me that something so extraordinary occurred from December 26th to December 28th, 1980, that it even had Lieutenant Colonel Charles Halt on the tape recording that was being recorded by the command post at their agreement, saying, "The lights are speaking to us. We are dealing with something that is drawing us." There were all of these verbs at various points on the audio tape as if Colonel Halt himself was getting some kind of, if not telepathic, certainly some kind of an impression from whatever these lights were. Is it possible that the very nature of the high-ranking number of military people who were there in those three nights and had experiences that the UK and the American government said, this can't, we can't let this out. We're going to mix dates. We're going to mix names. We're going to misinform this because we don't know what happened.
I would categorize it. I would come to a slightly different conclusion. I would say that there was a catastrophic failure of information sharing between the British and American on this. And I just want to go back to the point about the special relationship between Britain and America, because I think this is very important. One has to remember, and even Roswell has maybe a role in all of this, one has to remember the timing. In the late 40s and the early 50s in particular, there was actually a catastrophic breakdown of the special relationship between Britain and America, precisely because of a number of high-profile spy scandals. And actually, there were many people, for example, in the CIA, and James Jesus Angleton was mentioned earlier today, which I was very interested to hear, and there were a number of people in the American intelligence community who wanted to completely stop the flow of any intelligence or certainly sensitive intelligence from America to Britain, because they believed that Britain had been fundamentally penetrated at a number of levels by Soviet intelligence. And indeed, in some respects, they were right. We all know the names of people like Burgess and McLean and Blunt and Philby. And this, I think, might explain why, if Roswell was real and if some of these other things happened, why the Americans didn't perhaps decide to share that with their greatest ally.
And Paul Hellyer last year told me that the thing
Former Canadian defense minister.
Yes, Ministry of Defense. He said that the thing that stunned him was to realize that here he is, he's been out of government, he's retired. He knows a man who is an American general in the U.S. Air Force, also retiring, who tells him UFOs are real, everything in Lieutenant Colonel Philip J. Corso's book is absolutely accurate. In fact, does not include everything that is out there. And Paul Hellyer said, "Linda, I was stunned because I never, ever in my entire career in the Canadian government as Minister of Defense, I never saw a single document coming from the United States government about UFO activity. And yet, looking back historically, the time that he was Minister of Defense, when Pierre Trudeau was the Prime Minister, there was huge flaps of UFO activity in the United States."
Yes, and it would be inconceivable that someone somewhere wouldn't be looking at that. I mean, again, with my background in the Ministry of Defense, whatever you believe about UFOs, if there's something flying in your airspace, particularly if it's seen by military pilots and tracked on radar, it is undeniably a defense of national security issue,
and someone
will be taking a look at it. So yes.
Is that how this happened? Why you were assigned to this area? Did something specifically happen and they said, we've got to have somebody monitor this?
Oh no, I mean, Britain has been looking at the UFO issue since 1950.
So it must be serious to them.
It's something, the reason our UFO project survived and Project Blue Book didn't is probably because we were smaller and therefore cheaper. So we didn't, I mean, we didn't come under any kind of scrutiny in terms of why are you wasting time and money on this. So it was a small unit and it was able to continue its work kind of out of the public eye. And that work continues to this day. And of course, what we're seeing now in the media, and it's been on, I'm pleased to see it, not just in the British media, but in the American media on some fairly mainstream news shows. The British government in December 2007 made this commitment to release the UFO files. And of course, the reason why it's a 3 to 4 year process is because, as I just mentioned, we have been doing this since the 50s. There have been over 11,000 UFO sightings that we've got documentation on. And of course, the files contain more than just that. There's correspondence files, policy files, files detailing how this subject is handled when it's raised in the media or by members of parliament. So there's a lot of material.
And your point about exclusion of information between the United States and England was the point that Paul Hellyer was making. It meant that the United States wasn't communicating anything to England during Pierre Trudeau's administration.
Yeah, to the best. I mean, you see, I've been often accused either of being part of the cover-up or a disinformation campaign myself, or of being out of the loop and just not having access to the really sensitive information. I don't believe either of them. Well, I know the first one isn't true. I can't prove the second one isn't true. How can you prove a negative? That old chestnut. But I honestly think that the position is, the reason I haven't seen those sort of smoking gun documents in any British files is because we don't have them.
And if they don't have them in Canada, didn't have them, and the United States has been sitting on all of this, then it's possible, George, that this does go back to what Bob Wood suspects and what Andy Kissner said. He was told that Harry S. Truman signed a classified executive order to keep all things related to what they called extraterrestrial biological entities, to keep it completely under wraps in the interest of national security.
Something scared them, or as Nick says, they didn't want to share supposed technology.
And there is that majestic white hot document and the Interplanetary Phenomenon Unit that says that we found bodies dissected as one would a frog at landing zone one between Corona and Roswell, and that at landing zone two, bodies were outside of a craft. Neither one were disc-shaped. They were wedge-shaped. And inside of the craft at landing zone two, which is the Trinity site at White Sands, they allegedly found animal parts inside of that craft, or at least that's what the document suggests. And that goes right to the heart of how long has something from some place that we can't define been using livestock of this planet for reasons unknown.
Well, Nick, I want to tell you as we wrap this up that your credibility in this field and your expertise truly enhances not only conferences like this, but this entire field of people who have really, like Roger Lear and Stanton Friedman and Stephen Bassett and Richard Dolan, people who have devoted their lives to this. Your credibility really makes that worth it for them.
Thank you very much. And it's good to be in the studio, by the way, and not down the line from England at 4 in the morning.
Absolutely. And you're in Las Vegas.
Absolutely.
So enjoy,
too. Great fun.
We'll be back in just a moment with Linda Moulton Howe and more guests. I'm George Norrie, and we're live at the UFO Crash Retrieval Conference in Las Vegas.